History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest enough time to patiently listen as memories which may have been buried for a long, long time start to emerge once more. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from veterans who endured the kind of situations most of us can only imagine. As you know, over the years, we've focused almost exclusively on the World War II generation, but every once in a while, we make exceptions. And that's what we're going to do this week as we approach National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. Today, you'll meet a man with a unique assignment in Vietnam who has spent all these decades since carrying a substantial burden that he's going to share with us today. This interview was recorded at VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida, where this weekend is their big military gala. Thanks to Loretta Forlaw for introducing me to Swift Boat veteran Rex Perry, who lives in the Orlando area now but grew up about 800 miles north of there.
I am from Logan, West Virginia. It was a small mining town. At the time I was growing up, it was probably 15, maybe 20,000 people, and now it's probably 8,000 people. My father was a coal miner. My mother was a housewife. I had three brothers and one sister. My sister was older than me, and I'm the oldest son, and I'm the only one left. I volunteered for Swift Boats because my brother had went in the Army, and they wouldn't send brothers in a war zone together. And 2 weeks after I got back, they sent him, and he spent a year over there. And 6 months after he got back, he committed suicide from PTSD. They didn't know what it was back then. But we had gone home. We lived in Massachusetts at the time. And we had gone home, and I seen him, and he was a mess.
Before we get to that, let's talk about hopefully happier times. I'm always fascinated by the stuff that preceded your military service, too. And you mentioned, you know, being the son of a coal miner there in West Virginia, which in recent years has become kind of a hot-button issue, and I'm sure that's why the population has changed in your hometown, too. But what was life like? What are some of the things you remember with your brothers and sister in those early years?
The mountains were fantastic. That was my playground. I used to hunt, fish, camp. Once you had a friend and where I lived in the community I lived, you had a friend for life. The high school I went to, I was on the wrestling team, and it's too small to play football. So I became the manager of the football team. And I worked out with them to get in shape for wrestling after football. I lettered 3 years in wrestling. I still keep in contact with hundreds of my classmates to this day. Like I said, once you make a friend, you got a friend. It was a wonderful life. It was a hard life for my dad. He died of black lung. It was a very hard life for him, but he provided for the family. We had all the love a family could want. Like all families, you know. You have your ups and downs, but life in West Virginia was good. I wouldn't live there now. I mean, I go back to visit. My mother always said, when I got out of the Navy and stayed in Massachusetts, she always said that my wife was keeping me from coming back to West Virginia, and she wasn't. My dad always said he never wanted his sons to go in a coal mine. And out of the four of us, I'm the only one that never went in the coal mines. My three brothers worked in a coal mine, and I kept his wish. Massachusetts was good to me, but Florida's been a heck of a lot better.
How did you end up in the Navy? How old were you, and what happened?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I went to college. I spent two semesters there, and I said, man, this ain't for me. I was 18 at the time. Well, I turned 19, and I dropped out. It really made my parents mad. And I went down. I didn't join the Army because I couldn't see getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and putting a backpack on and running 5 miles for breakfast. I says, that ain't for me. And I checked the Marine Corps and the Air Force, and the Navy I checked, and the Navy has more schools than any other branch of service. Anything you want to do, the Navy has got a school for it. We had schools in Newport that Marines went to, that Army and Air Force went to. They came to our schools. So I chose the Navy. My first duty station was New London, Connecticut, after boot camp. I wanted to go into submarines, and this was right after the Thresher had went down. I got to school, and 3 weeks into school, they took us out on a submarine, and it was the old sewer pipe type. It wasn't a nuclear, and I got claustrophobia. So I dropped out. I couldn't handle the spaces. They asked me where I wanted to go, and I said, I want to go to Newport, Rhode Island. And they sent me to a tin can in Newport. My first cruise was to the Med. We came back. Then we went to Boston to the shipyard and had work done on the ship there. Spent about 3 months. I got in trouble with my mother at the time. It's the first time I'd been in a really big city. You know, Boston. And I was having a good old time. She got in touch with the Red Cross. The Red Cross got the number of the ship. She called the captain. And captain called me in and says, you know who I just talked to? I said, who? He says, your mother. Said, okay. And I was 20 at the time. He says, she said that you haven't written or called home in 3 months. I said, so? And he says, it ain't going to go so on my ship. He says, you will. Either call or write your mother once a month as long as I'm on this ship. I don't want to see no more phone calls from a mother. I said, well, Captain, I said, I'm 20 years old. I'm in the Navy. I can do what I want. He's not on my ship. So I ended up writing letters once a month. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was that ship?
It was a destroyer. The USS Davis, DD-937. It was a Sherman-class ship. As a matter of fact, they've had one. It was a presidential ship. They have one in Washington on the Potomac. But I read here a few months ago that they were going to decommission it and turn it into razor blades. So it was a good ship. It was fairly new. Had a very good crew on it. We had some very good captains. The year before the ship went to Vietnam in 1966, we won the Arleigh Burke Award, which is the best ship in the Atlantic Fleet. When we started around the world, we went through the Panama Canal, and then we went to San Diego. And the ship that had won the award on the Pacific side was in port, and we swapped plaques because they give you a big plaque. And they had a little ceremony on that. And then we went, to Hawaii and the Philippines, then to Vietnam, doing some bombardment and plane guarding for the aircraft carriers. Went to Taiwan, Japan, Hong Kong, Australia, and then after we were cut loose to come on around the world, we went to India, one little country at the mouth of the Red Sea, and we stopped there and went through the Red Sea. I got a picture in here of what we went through. Went into the Mediterranean again and went to Greece and Italy, Spain, Mallorca, which is a small island off of Spain, and went to Gibraltar and went back to Newport. And anytime, we were gone for, 3 or 4 months, maybe 5. There is nothing like being on a ship, coming on the horizon, and seeing America. It is the most prettiest sight in the world. I always remember that. I always got up early in the morning because we usually docked around 8 o'clock. And I always got up about 5 o'clock, got a cup of coffee, went up on a torpedo deck and sat out there and watch it come up. But every time we went out, I did this. After we left the yards in Boston, we went to Guantanamo Bay for a shakedown to make sure everything was okay and everything. But that was that part of my life, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And what about your duties on that destroyer?
I stood sonar watches because the sonarman and torpedoman, their berthing space was together. I had to stand sonar watches with another sonarman. My duty was to keep the torpedo deck clean and make sure all the maintenance was done on the torpedo tubes and so forth. Then when we were in port, if I had the duty, a lot of times I had to stand quarterdeck watches and so forth.
And, you mentioned
going to Vietnam and doing some bombardment and plane guarding out there. Was that an eye-opening experience for you? Because now all of a sudden you're in a war zone, and I don't know if that's what you signed up for, but now you're there.
It wasn't really an eye-opener because, you know, we were 10 miles out. I had a crew on the number one gun. It was the 5-inch 54s, the big ones that set usually on the forecastle and on the fantail. And usually some of them, we had three, one set on top of the 01 deck. I had a crew that when we fired, down in the bottom of the ship was all the ammunition for that weapon. We were on the forward one. I had a crew that they would take the projectile, we'd put it in one place, and then take a container that held all the powder in it, slide it in, and then it went up, and when it went into the gun, it pushed the projectile into, and they would fire. And sometimes when they would fire, the thing rotated. You filled it up, and then as it come around and was empty, you put another one in, because you never knew how many they would fire. When it went off, you felt it. Seemed like it would just shake. And I've been told that the battleships, as big as a battleship is, if they turned all those big guns to, say, starboard and fire them all at once, it would move that ship sideways in the water as big as it was. When we get back to Vietnam on the swift boat, we had an experience with one of them.
And I don't want to leave anything out about your tin can sailor life, if you have anything else to add there. But that was a big transition you made from a destroyer, which among ships is fairly small, to something a lot smaller than that.
The Davis was, I think, around 350 foot long. The swift boat was 50 foot long. The Davis had a crew of like 325. The swift boat had a crew of six. So that was a big transition.
Well, and before we hear about it, I mean, I've got to ask this question, because I've had so many veterans over the years, probably hundreds of them, tell me you never volunteer for anything in the military. But that sounds like a rule that you broke to get into swift boats.
It is. I don't say you don't volunteer for anything. Maybe in the Army. But it didn't bother me to volunteer. It was a job that had to be done, and they need volunteers, I go.
And what was it about swift boats that caught your eye?
Excitement. I'd talked to a couple of the crews and everything, and it wasn't military. We wore cut-off dungarees, no T-shirts, no hats. We didn't salute. I mean, we used yes, sir, and no, sir, toward our boat officer, but he wore cut-off khakis, no T-shirt. I mean, it's too damn hot, you know. But just the excitement of it really caught my eye.
Well, and I want to hear about it. And on your hat here, you're wearing the pin of Coastal Division 13 with the big black cat with its paws on a swift boat. Cat Low is where you guys were stationed. Give us an idea of some of the things you guys were assigned. What were you supposed to be doing over there?
Well, when I first got there, we patrolled the coast. We searched sandpans. There was thousands of them. We'd go alongside, and I was up in the forward gun tub, and I had a 12-gauge shotgun because the 50s wouldn't go down enough alongside that way, and I always had a 12-gauge pump shotgun. One guy would go, and sometimes two guys, according to how big it was, go aboard and take their papers and hand them to the boat officer. We would go through the boat checking for weapons, extra rice. If they had 50 pounds of rice, we knew that they were taking it to the VC because they only took enough to survive, because they ate some of the fish that they caught and so forth. That was called market time. And then after about 3 months, we got the go-ahead to go into the rivers and start going up the rivers and patrolling the rivers in the Delta. We would get calls from the Army and the Marines and so forth that we need mortars. There's another story once we get on in on that.
Well, yeah, and maybe leading into that, you mentioned, you know, the gun tub up front, 50 calibers there. You're holding the shotgun for the stuff that can't reach, and then there's a mortar on the back of this 50-foot boat. Any other armaments that you guys were carrying?
We had the 81 mortar, the 350s. Sometimes we would have a 20-millimeter, and then we had six AR-15s. We had a 38 pistol, which a boat officer used. We had a M79 grenade launcher and the shotgun. That was it. And the boat was made out of quarter-inch aluminum.
Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot of protection there. And for, you know, for some people, those who are familiar with the Swift boats, they have an idea of what your mission and your purpose was there. But others may not be familiar. So how did you understand your mission or your purpose for where you were?
I just followed orders, and they sent us on patrol. Catlow was our main base. When we came out of the river, you could go north or you could go south. And we had a 20-mile sector that one boat patrolled. And then they had another boat in the next sector, and his was maybe 20 miles. And he would patrol that. Now, when you first got there and you got your boat, naturally, they send you to the farthest zone because it takes you longer to get in. And the guy that's in the first zone, he's due to go home within a month or so. So he's up front. And then once that boat leaves, the guy's behind him. That's the way they worked us. We worked off of an LST when we went down south. We would take extra clothing, shaving gear. Our patrols were 24 hours on and 24 hours off. We were at the base. We still went on patrol. But when we came in and we had 24 hours off.
Well, and as far as explaining what you're looking for, you mentioned, you know, with the rice, if they had that much, they're supplying the VC. You're looking for maybe actual enemy as well on some of these patrols?
It's been known that enemy's been on them and threw hand grenades. But basically, we were looking for extra food, weapons, and ammunition. And if their papers wasn't in order, then, you know, we could take them in or whatever.
I guess, you know, one thing that comes to mind as I try to imagine myself in your shoes is, what level of tension are you feeling as you carry out those duties? I mean, are you on constant alert for those 24 hours, wondering what's around the next bend? Or was it as calm and matter of fact as you kind of make it sound?
I'll just put it this way. I've been back 55 years, and my wife, when she wakes me up, she throws a shoe at me or something. I don't like fireworks. I hate New Year's. I hate when they put off fireworks. I go into my man cave at home and turn the TV up, take my hearing aids out. I can't stand them. The tension over there, it's according to how far you were out and everything. If you were half a mile out or so, you relax a little bit. But when you start going in the river, you're on alert. You're always looking and checking. I don't like anybody to come up behind me and say boo. I don't like that at all. My granddaughter, she has a very bad habit of it.
Well, that's one thing we won't do, but one thing we do need to do is take our first break. There's much more to come in this special edition of Hometown Heroes, preparing you for National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. Find out about observances where you live and take that opportunity to thank the Vietnam vets in your life. When we come back, why one particular name on the wall in Washington, D.C. holds special meaning for Rex. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton. With experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support.
When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Vietnam veteran Rex Perry, getting you ready for National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. Originally from West Virginia, Rex lives in Florida now, but 55 years ago he was on a swift boat in Southeast Asia, having volunteered for that dangerous duty after starting out his Navy career on a destroyer.
I'm looking at your shirt. It's a custom shirt. It's got your name, Perry. It says, all gave some, and then it says 58,479 gave all.
All gave some gave all.
Right.
And the back's the same way.
Well, and you put a number on that. How many gave all in Vietnam? And of course, those are the names that are on that wall in Washington, D.C. And I saw a name in your scrapbook here that you've gone and taken a rubbing of. And that goes back to your boat in Vietnam that you were just talking about. What happened there?
We were firing our mortar. The plan of the day for it, there was three boats. We were the first boat. We were to go around and fire 10 mortars and then move around. The other boat would go up and fire 10. After we fired our 10, I was the gunner's mate. I was supposed to switch places with Gary and fire 10. And after he fired 10 and we were moving around, I had a mic and I called down to the boat officer. I said, Mr. Keating, do you want me to go back now? He said, no. He said, let him fire two more rounds. And then you go back. After the other two boats had fired, we went up and got in position, and they fired the 11th round, and they dropped the 12th round in, and the mortar blew up, and I seen Gary go over the side, spread eagle. I can't get it out of my mind. And I ran to the other side of the boat and turned Scott over. He had an arm missing and his leg was broken. He had shrapnel in his face. He didn't have his shrapnel jacket closed. He had shrapnel down his chest and in his stomach. And I lived with it.
And I know it's not easy to talk about, and I can see that all over your face. And I so respect your willingness and the courage it takes to talk about and help us understand this reality. So this is Gary Friedman. This is a guy who's been on your boat. You must have known each other really well.
Oh, yeah. The whole crew. We trained together and so forth. It was just amazing how close you can get, you know, with six guys living on the boat. When you're in port, you're going out drinking and so forth. It's your family. I mean, matter of fact, I talked to two of them yesterday. We call each other at least once or twice a month.
So you see this mortar blow up. You see your friend Gary blown off the boat, and then you see your friend Scott missing an arm and wounded in the torso. I can't imagine what that feels like to witness that, but then a lot of us, I think, would freeze, not know what to do, but there are some things that you sprang into action and did there.
The thing that I found out that the Navy, when we went through our training, tuned us, and when we seen something like the accident, and me turning Scott over, it just clicked. You got to do this, or you should do this, or you should do that, you know. And it was the same way if you was up a river and you got in a firefight. You automatically do certain things. Your adrenaline is going and so forth, and it's just you're trained that way.
So tell me what you did in those moments.
I did my job. If I was, you know, like when I turned Scott over and he's missing an arm and missing the muscle out of his leg and his leg was broken, I immediately pulled my belt off and put it around his arm. And when Stan come running through the cabin, I said, give me your belt, and I threw it around his leg. He's alive today.
And he wouldn't be if you didn't do that.
He'd probably be dead, you know. Like I told you before, at reunions and so forth, he hugs me and I hug him. And just feeling his back, you can tell his bones are not normal. You know, that's how bad he was. He's blind to the point to where he can't, they won't give him a driver's license, but he still drives.
I hope they're not listening where he lives.
He owns a house in North Dakota, and he owns a house in San Diego. He spends the summers in North Dakota and the winters in San Diego, and he drives a lot of times. And I said, you ever been stopped? He goes, oh, yeah, I got all kinds of tickets. Yeah. But he, you know, he does it. He works on his car and everything. I says, how do you work on your car? How do you change your oil? And he says, all right, Rex, look at it this way. I got one arm. He said, if it takes you an hour to change your oil with two hands, it takes me 2 hours with one hand. And him and Stan, they've been to my home and spent a week or two. And we'd go out, and I had season tickets to the Magic. I had three seats. I told my son and my wife, I said, I'd like to take them to a game. They said, okay, go ahead, take them. So we went to a game, and we was clapping and everything, and Scott was doing this on his leg. And I said, Scott, if you want to clap a hand, here, take this one, you know. And, you know, we'd joke about it, and he would laugh about it, and he would joke about it. He was just that type of guy, you know. And Stan was from Israel, and he spent 2 years in the Israeli army, came to America, got his green card, and in 1966, the Navy needed 2,500 guys, and they drafted 2,500 men into the Navy, and Stan Slomovitz was one of them. They gave him Swift boats. Swift boats, 99% was volunteer. In the 7 years from 65 to 72, there was between, I want to say around 3,200, 3,300 of us. We were there during the seven-day war in Israel, and Stan had his radio stuck to his ear. And when Israel won in 7 days, he goes, Rex, that's how you fight a war. Yeah. He says, you go in and you do it, and that's it, you know. And we still laugh about that, you know.
And I hate to take you back to that day that we're talking about, but I think there's more that the rest of us need to understand about it. And first of all, I'm just, you know, thinking again about what you did. So you see all this, you get the bleeding stopped in both limbs there. Were you ever decorated for that?
I didn't want to be decorated, no. After I took Stan's belt and everything, see, I was the exec of the boat at the time because I had the highest rate. Mm-hmm. We had a lieutenant, and then the highest rate guy on the boat was what you call the exec. I left. I told Stan, you stay with Scott. I'm going to go report to Mr. Keating. I went up to report to Mr. Keating, and the division commander would happen to be aboard our boat that morning that it happened. And I went up and told him. Now, about 2 weeks later, we all met on the pier, and Stan got an accommodation, a written accommodation from the commander. As far as me, I didn't want any. I didn't need any.
You turned it down?
No. It wasn't offered, but I would have turned it down. I did my job, you know.
And did you know instantly that Gary was killed, or were you hoping that he...
Yeah, I knew, but I still threw the life ring just in case. But when I turned Scott over and seen him, see, the mortar's pointing this way. Scott was the loader. He drops him in. Gary was behind the mortar, all right, and we were trigger firing. He had his hand on a trigger, and he was just waiting for the word to say fire, okay? Now, once Scott dropped it in, he bends over down in a cross position. Well, Gary's standing up, and when it blew up, the percussion hit Gary directly in the chest, you know, and, I mean, he was 10 feet in the air. And then since Scott was bent over, he was blown against the stanchion, and that's the way it went down.
And I know it's kind of gruesome to talk about, but in some situations like that, you might have a family that never recovers the remains of a sailor. But you guys were able to recover his remains?
A fisherman found him in a fish trap. A fish trap in Vietnam was at the mouth of the river. They'd put poles for maybe 20 or 30 feet, sometimes shorter, sometimes longer. And they would put boards across them. And lay a pole across the top, and they would drop their nets over. And when the tide come in, it would catch the fish and the shrimp, and they would pull it up. When the tide came in, 3 days later, the guy pulled Gary up, and he immediately called either the Army base or the Naval base.
And there's another piece to this that, as you described that day, you were supposed to be the one firing that round, but Gary was there to fire it instead. And, you know, you mentioned you've been carrying this with you ever since. How do you process that piece of it, that initially you were supposed to be the one on that mortar?
Up until 2 years ago, I had been to 4 or 5 psychologists, different psychologists at the VA. Since I was the gunner's mate, I had to check each weapon. We had a filler gauge that it had to be a certain one on the mortar. Well, Scott had been to gunner's mate school, but he knew more about engines than I did. So he became the engineman and I became the gunner's mate. But when I checked the weapons with the filler gauge and everything, he was there with me. I said, you check it. And he checked it. He says, you're right on. And I blame myself being the gunner's mate. And they call it, I guess, survivor's guilt. And all these years, I blame myself. All right. Gary's family said it wasn't your fault, you know. And all the psychologists tried to tell me, but they never helped me well. I finally got a psychologist that we went through it. She finally made me understand that it wasn't my fault. And it took 53 years for me to... I'm not over it. Don't get me wrong. I still dream about it. I still wake up shaking and crying about it and so forth. But I have come to the realization it was not my fault, you know. And it took me all those years to do that. And what hurts me more about the VA, like I said, I've been to 4 or 5 psychologists. And each time I have to go over the story like I'm going over it with you. And you mentioned earlier that you could tell by my face. Well, I have the same thing going over it with them and redoing everything again. And instead of just staying with one psychologist, I know they retire, I know they move on, but boy, it happened too many times with me. I'd go in and there'd be a new person. I'd go, God, here we go again, you know.
And that's, you know, one of the reasons I so appreciate your willingness to share this is I know that there are other veterans out there listening to this right now who maybe experienced similar things and have carried similar burdens for years and may or may not have felt the release or a little bit of freedom that you finally felt 2 years ago as you shared. But there's more to this story when it comes to Gary, because your caring for him didn't end that day when he was killed. You eventually had a chance to go see his mother and speak to her and explain to her what had happened?
Yeah. Like I said, I was from West Virginia and my duty station was in Rhode Island. And when I left West Virginia, I had to cross part of the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And I seen a sign for Lebanon, Pennsylvania, which is right next to Hershey. I debated whether to go. I knew the address. So I went and knocked on the door. And it took me an hour to get out of my car, but I eventually got out and knocked on the door. Mrs. Friedman answered. I told her, I said, Mrs. Friedman, and she said, yes. I says, my name's Rex Perry, and I was with Gary when he was killed. And she said, come in. I had planned to spend 2 or 3 hours, ended up spending 3 days. I visited his grave, and we became very good friends. When I met my wife, and I took her to West Virginia. She was my fiance at the time. And her mother says, where you staying before you get to West Virginia? I told her about Mr. and Mrs. Friedman. And I had called them and they said, come on by. And we stayed with them for a night and went on to West Virginia. And then on the way back, we stayed with them and went on to Massachusetts. When we got married, they came to my wedding. The boat officer was there. Scott was there. Stan was there. So all my crew was there except for the radioman, and they got to meet Mr. and Mrs. Friedman. I met his sister, and I met his brother. And then here about, I guess 25, no longer than that, probably 30 years ago, they had the moving wall to go to Lebanon. And Gary's sister and brother lives here in Florida. And they were going to fly up and go with their mom and dad because the wall was set up at the football field where Gary played football in high school. His sister called me and told me they were going, and I'd always told Mrs. Friedman, because they had never went to the wall in Washington. I told them, I said, if you ever go to the wall and you would like for me to go, I'll fly to Washington. So Suze called me and she said, the moving wall's in Lebanon. Would you like to go? Would you go up and go with? I said, sure. So I flew and I went with the family to the wall that night. And it was a moving experience. All of his friends were there that he'd went to high school with and played football with. And I met all of them, and we've still kept in contact, you know.
It's time for another break, but we'll hear more of Rex's reflections on his late friend Gary Friedman when we come back. Again, March 29th, National Vietnam War Veterans Day. Make your plans now, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode getting you ready for National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. Navy veteran Rex Perry served in Vietnam, first on a destroyer, then on swift boats. You heard him describe an incident that took place just over 55 years ago on March 10th, 1967. When their six-man boat crew was rocked by a mortar accident that cost his friend Scott Meade his arm. For another young man Rex had gotten to know quite well, Gary Friedman from Lebanon, Pennsylvania, it cost him his life.
In your scrapbook here, you have that rubbing that was taken from the wall where his name is among 58,000 others. What do you think of when you look at that, when you see that name, that pencil on paper with his name rubbed in?
Well, 3 years after they put the wall up, my wife and I went to Massachusetts because we lived down here. And I told her I'd like to stop in Washington and see the wall. And she said, okay. And on the way back, we stopped. And when I walked up and touched his name, I thought I was okay. You know, I was jumpy, you know, somebody fired a shot or something like that, but I thought I was okay. And when I touched his name, I broke down. I mean, I literally went to my knees. And I just cried. Just couldn't stop. Finally, after about 15 minutes, my wife says, "I think we better go." And she drove. I mean, and just things started coming back. The nightmares, everything. We got home, and then about a month later, the moving wall came to the fairgrounds, and I went to it. I asked my wife to go with me, and she says, "No, I can't go." My son says, "Come on, Dad, I'll go with you." And we went, and I broke down again. And then it went on, and I wasn't sleeping, wasn't eating good. And between my family and my friends, they talked me into going to the VA. And that's when I first started my therapy. And after a year of one-on-one, they put us in a group, and they set us in a circle. Psychologist was here, I was here, and she started here, and you went around to each one. There was 10 of us in that circle, and you told your name, what unit you were with, and so forth, and where you served in Vietnam. When it got to me, I told them my name. I said I was in the Navy. One of the Army guys spoke up and said, "Well, what the hell are you doing in here? You were 100 miles out." And I says, "Well, I wish I was." I says, "I was on a swift boat to patrol the Delta." He says, "You are crazy." He says, "You had no place to run, no place to hide." He says, "You need to be here, and we need to get up and leave." I've gotten that a lot. Told me I was crazy. You think I was crazy too, don't you?
I know this question is a real hard one to answer probably, but one that I'm sure some people listening are wondering too, as we're talking about your story, but your story on that day, all those years ago, became intertwined with Gary's story. Have you ever thought about, pondered, considered maybe what kind of life he would have led if he had had these years that you've had?
Oh, yeah. I ponder the life that Scott has. I ponder the life of each one of my crew. Gary, he worked for the phone company, installation, and he would have got that job back after he got out of the Navy. Gary was happy-go-lucky. When we were going through training, him and Scott, we always called Scott the general because his name was Meade, General Meade, you know. And we always called Gary his aide because they were all together. And they was always late for muster in the morning. And they'd come walking up. Gary would always have an apple in his hand, always. Every day he had an apple in his hand. He'd be tossing it up and down. He'd eat it during the day, but he was real happy and everything. I had an Austin Healey. Three of us would jump in it and go to Tijuana. We'd go down there and have a ball. I was 21, they weren't. So they could drink in Tijuana. But he was really a happy young man. He always made you laugh, always had a smile on his face. You know, he was just great to be around.
Well, thank you for going there with us and helping us understand what you've lived all these years. I don't want to gloss over anything else you experienced there in your time in the swift boats, because now you have the perspective of other veterans, like you mentioned, the Army veterans, saying, "Hey, well, that was pretty crazy what you did." And so few did it. I mean, it was such a unique part of the war in Vietnam, and a lot of people didn't even know it was happening for a long time.
The thing is, as much as the swift boaters hate John Kerry, okay, he was the one that made it known what swift boats are. You wouldn't have known, or you wouldn't have known what swift boat was unless it was for John Kerry. That's the only thing I'll give to that man, you know. But he was the one that brought out swift boaters.
So what else do you think we need to know about swift boaters and the contributions that you all made over there?
Swift boaters are unique in a lot of ways. You could walk through that door and come up to me and introduce yourself, and I'd say, "Where you served?" And he said, "I was in the Navy, and I was on swift boats." Immediately, we're brothers. I mean, I got guys on my Facebook that I didn't know in Vietnam, but we have a common bond together as swift boaters. They know what I went through. I know what they went through. And we understand each other, and the reunions are just fantastic. They are really, really good. When we had it in St. Louis, Budweiser provided the beer for us for 5 days. And I think there was 950 of us.
Yeah. So when are you going back to St. Louis?
I don't. But at the reunions, I mean, I've been to 10 or 12 of them, probably. And I didn't know them in Vietnam, but I know them now. We'd stand outside at the smoke cigarettes and tell war stories and lies and stuff like that. Yeah, it's a unique bunch of men.
And as far as the impact of the work that you guys did there, is there a way you would describe that or explain that, encapsulate that for people who weren't there or don't know?
It would be hard for me to explain. The people in Vietnam, the people themselves, are fantastic people. And like every place, it's the government. I've got a lot of friends that have gone back to Vietnam. They had a contingent going out of Missouri before the pandemic hit. And the guy that was getting it up, I wanted to go, but I wouldn't have been able to go because my wife has had a stroke and I'm the caretaker. But he has been back, that would have been his third time. Rex, he says, you wouldn't believe the way it's changed. Everything has changed. Said, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful country. It was beautiful. It was war-torn, but it was a beautiful country. A lot of people would tell me, I don't see how you took it and so forth. It was a job. We only lost 50 guys in 7 years, but we had a lot of wounded.
Yeah, on that note, did you have any other close calls that kind of stand out in your mind where it could have been you, almost was you?
A couple. A guy that I worked with asked me if his girlfriend could call me and ask me some questions about Vietnam. Not sure, have her to call me. And she called me and she asked all kinds of questions. And I get the question all the time. Not all the time anymore, but used to get the question all the time. Have you killed anybody? I said, I don't talk about it. You know, and that's another thing that I don't talk about. That's just the way I feel. I said, I won't answer that. All right? That's just it.
And on your Vietnam veteran hat, you've got a pin on there that's relatively new. At first glance, I almost thought you were on submarines because it kind of looks like the dolphins that those submariners wear, but it's not, and it's got three different kinds of boats on it. But that's a relatively new development. What did it mean to you and your fellow Swift boaters when the government issued those pins or approved them finally?
We were happy about it because we always felt that we deserved it. You know, a small boat pin. When they finally approved it, and well, they had to come up with a design and everything, and they finally got it approved at, I want to say we were in San Diego. When we went into dinner, they had guys standing there handing them out. I wear mine proudly. I'm a lover and a fighter and a swift boat rider.
And earlier on, you know, you mentioned your brother had served in Vietnam and what happened to him not long after he came home. What do you think is important for us to know about him, the significance of his service, his legacy, how you carry that forward and try to honor him as well?
Well, I try to keep him in my prayers every day. I mean, he was my youngest brother. He was married and had two children. He had a bad scene around Christmas time. He pulled a shotgun out, blew the Christmas tree away. His wife grabbed the girls and went to my parents' house, which was about a half a mile away. They called the state police and they came, and it took them a couple hours to talk him out of it. They took him to the hospital. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. They had a Filipino doctor there, and he was saying, I'll kill him, get him away. So they had to get an American doctor. They got him settled down and so forth. And he had went into some like rehab. Like I said, PTSD wasn't known back in. And about 6 months later, he lost it again, jumped in his car, and where we live, there's a stretch of road that they call a three-mile curve. If you go back on top of the mountain and look down at it, it looks like a dog's hind leg. He turned his car into the river. They found him 3 months later, 50 miles downriver. They said, you know, he committed suicide. But when I had went to West Virginia, my wife and I, we went to the hospital when he was in the rehab thing, and we seen him. And later on, he told his wife, and she told me, that he didn't even know I was there. We spent 2 or 3 hours with him. Said he didn't even know talking to me.
Well, and that's another issue that we haven't solved yet is, you know, a lot of people know that just today, they say 22 veterans a day commit suicide. And there are a lot of organizations trying to do something about that. And maybe by sharing some of the stories, sharing things like what you've been through, it'll encourage those who need help to go get help.
I read 2 or 3 months ago where They said that 390 Vietnam vets are dying every day. And they said by the year 25 that there will be none or very few Vietnam vets. So we're dying quicker than any other war we've ever had due to Agent Orange, suicide, and so forth. You know, when we got back, we were trash when we got back, you know. And we only did what we were trained to do and what we were told to do. My daughter-in-law's mother, I was talking to her. My grandson started growing his hair. And I said, man, you need a haircut. Because she goes, no. She says, you know, I was raised in the 60s and said, it was long hairs and everything. And I almost said, was you the one that Travis throwing stuff at me and called me baby killer? I almost said that because she's from California. September 11th, I was chosen a year ago to go on an honor flight. It was postponed. But September 11th of 21, I finally went with 25 other veterans out of Melbourne. When we got on that bus, came to Orlando, we had a police escort, plus we had a contingent from the Rolling Thunders in front of us. We got to the airport, got off. We had to be in a wheelchair. And my son, I asked if he could be my guardian, and they said, yeah. And he flew down from North Carolina and went with me. When we went through the Orlando airport, people were standing up, thanking us for our service, coming over, shaking our hands, and everything. We had a World War II veteran that was 92 years old with us. We had a guy that was born and raised in Alaska that was in Vietnam. He had 3 silver stars and 7 bronze stars with a combat V. They were chosen to lay the wreath at the unknown soldier. But when we got to Baltimore, we got off the plane and started through the airport, and people were doing the same thing. When we got to Washington, went to the World War II Memorial. It has a gallery at the top, and then you can go down where the fountain is. Well, we went down where the fountain is, and they took a photo, and people were holding up signs, welcome home, thank you for your service and everything. And as we walked from there to the Korean Memorial, to the Vietnam Memorial and so forth, people were just stopping and thanking us, you know. Well, I was just with my son because they scattered and we had to meet in one place. And people were thanking me and everything else. My son said, Pop, he says, you know, he says, I was beginning to lose faith in the American people. But said, this trip has changed my mind. He says, the way they're treating you guys and just being with you and the way I see they're treating you and I know what you went through. He said, it's amazing. Then we went to the Vietnam Memorial, and he says, you know what panel Gary's name's on? I said, of course. So we go, found his name, and he said, they told us that there would be someone here with paper to rub his name off. I says, I got one. He says, well, I want to get one from your grandson. So I looked around, there was a lady up there, and I got out of the wheelchair and went over. I says, are you the lady that has the paper to scratch a name? She said, yes. She says, you know where it is? I said, yes, ma'am. She says, come on. I went and I started to take the picture. She said, no, let me do it for you. And she did it. And she asked me, she said, was you with this young man? I said, yes, ma'am. I said, he was on my riverboat. She says, what kind of boat were you on? I told her a swift boat. She says, I have seen movies. I have seen things on YouTube about swift boats. She says, oh, my God, you know, what you guys went through. We must talk to her 15 or 20 minutes. She was just like you, full of questions. I told her, I said, well, we have to leave now to meet up with the contingents because we were going to Arlington. And she says, just a minute, I got to give you a hug. She says, you're the first swift boat sailor I've ever met. So I hugged her. We met up with the contingent and went to Arlington. And then we got back on the bus and went to Baltimore to get the plane. And we left at 2:00 in the morning, and we got back at 2:00 in the morning. It's a 24-hour trip. When we got back to Orlando, and we got off the monorail, there was a Boy Scout troop. The TSA Honor Guard was there. The Boy Scouts were shaking our hands and saying, welcome home. And the TSA was, you know, at a salute. And we got through. And then when we got back to Melbourne, the Honor Guard from Patrick Air Force Base was there. And they had crossed swords when we got off the bus that we went under. I've had people, and it took many, many years for people to thank me for my service. And I would say thank you, and you know, but I never felt welcomed home. But the honor trip to Washington, I felt like I was finally welcomed home after 55 years. It's still with me. I'm still in a glow about it. The feeling I have that the welcome we got, and it just felt like my welcome home.
Well, let me add welcome home. And thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for sharing a story with us that nobody else could. Is there anything else that you think is important for us to know?
God bless America. And if I see servicemen, I always tell them welcome home, because I know how it feels.
Sounds like an example we would all do well to follow. Thanks to Rex Perry and again to VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida, for allowing us to record Rex's powerful story there. For every one of those more than 58,000 names on the wall in Washington, names like Gary Friedman, there's another one like Scott Mead, dealing with significant visible injuries, and still more like Rex Perry and his late brother, battling the invisible injuries that can sometimes prove even more devastating. March 29th is National Vietnam War Veterans Day. Rex Perry gave us an example of what we can do to honor the Vietnam vets where we live, so let's make sure they hear a thank you and a welcome home, shall we? Thanks for listening to this special edition of Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.